Hello, everyone, and welcome to Author Talk for this fine day, beautiful day here in Vancouver, and glad to have you aboard. I'm going to talk about something that I know a little bit about and have had a lot of fun around. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this interview. The book is called Warbird Recovery, The Hunt for a Rare World War II Plane in Siberia. Gordon R. Page is with us. Gordon is past president of the Colorado Aviation Historical Society and opened the Colorado Aviation Hall of Fame in Denver. He lives with his family in Louisville, Colorado, where he owns and operates an aircraft sales and charter business. And let's just send you to the website right now while Gordon and I are talking. The website is warbirdrecovery.com. Gordon, welcome to the program.
Hey, Alan, thanks for having me on today. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, well, this is great and going to be fun because I have a little bit of a background in this. I was involved in aviation for a number of years, flew demonstration planes at air shows all over the country. And, of course, one of the most beautiful things to watch are all the warbirds and how just the work that goes into to making them, restoring them, first of all, of course, and then making them in better shape than when they came out of the factory. Been to Oshkosh a number of times and seen the lineup of Warbird airplanes. And, of course, your work is more about, way more about what happens before they get to the show line. This book, I guess, just give us the story of this book, and then we'll have some questions.
Well, great. Well, first of all, this is a don't try this at home story about what it took to try to deal with the Russian mafia and the KGB to try to recover some of these World War II planes. It really all started as an April Fool's joke with a wealthy investor buddy of mine in Alabama, and I really didn't think I'd ever be involved in this type of business or this opportunity. But originally, we put some money together and went to Siberia thinking we were going to pick up a bunch of American and Japanese fighter aircraft. And the bottom line was, these guys, I tell you, this is early in the 90s, and right after the wall had come down, and they told us, hey, just bring a pile of cash out with you, and all you need is gas and oil, and put that in the airplane, you can fly these things off. Well, needless to say, it was not as advertised. And what I've tried to do, even on the back of the cover of the book, is I put a photograph on there of the best example after flying 26 hours one way from Denver to try to get to Siberia. Needless to say, I was a little bit disappointed and ripped off after that first trip, too.
Now, let me just get the date straight. Had the wall fallen by that time?
Yeah, the wall came down in 1989. So, 1992, we were the first Americans that went into the Kuril Islands north of Hokkaido, Japan. So these islands are even disputed to this day of who really owns them, because the Russians kind of took them towards the end of the war and really wanted it for fishing and mineral rights in that area. So it was pretty fought-over area and territory, and it's one of the places that we sent a lot of American Lend-Lease aircraft to try to defend against the Japanese.
And there was some speculation that there were some pretty rare aircraft there, you know, special aircraft. And tell us about that.
Well, not as advertised, but what we were told was that there were some really special Japanese fighters, some really rare ones, and the way they were manufactured and, you know, shot down and satchel bombed and all at the end of the war, none of these airplanes really existed that we were told that were there. So our initial intent was to go and try to recover, you know, 19 American fighter aircraft and a bunch of Japanese fighters. Basically, the types were not available or known to anybody else in the world at that point. But what we found out was we got all the way over there initially and found out these airplanes were what they, and put in parentheses around, there's your quotes around it saying open. And what that meant is they were blown open by bombs or whatever. And not much of those aircraft were actually there. Again, not as advertised.
Take us through some of the high points of the book, Gordon.
Well, I think really what I try to do in the book is tell people from my heart what it was like. Maybe I was naive, but I try to tell people I was more passionate trying to go after some of these models I built as kids. And that's actually how I start my book off, is I want the reader to understand why and how I got my passion for aviation. and probably like you, Alan, is, you know, we started building models as kids and progressed up from there in radio controlled, and then eventually started taking flying lessons for our private pilot and kept moving from there. So I really start the book that way, but I got sucked into this deal not really thinking I would ever be over there trying to get these airplanes. First of all, it's expensive to try to just go to a magazine or some of these other trade journals and purchase one of these World War II fighters. I mean, it could be in the millions of dollars now. So we had an opportunity to raise a fraction of that amount of money and go recover multiples of that. So it was more of a treasure hunt for us than it was just ordering a plane out of a catalog. So that was exciting to me, that I could be creating in actually our own aviation history at that point. But and I have to be honest with you, when I did this entire venture, I didn't intend on writing a book about it. It was the encouragement of my wife that had me keep a really good journal, and I think for two reasons. One is to tell the kids and the grandkids someday about one of our adventures we had done, but more importantly, if I didn't come back, there might have been some document out there to kind of indicate what happened to us.
You know, we live in the Western world here, and, you know, Canadians are no different than Americans in that we're pretty naive in the ways of the way things work. When as soon as, you know, the Russian mafia and the KGB and a few other groups, you know, Motley Crues like that get involved, then all kinds of fun things happen. Tell us about some of that happened on the trips over there.
Well, how about a flight from New York to Moscow? And there's a guy who'd never been to Russia, and, you know, I had no expectation. But no kidding, half a mile outside of the airport in this little teeny car full of smoke, everybody smokes over there, we get pulled over by a couple plainclothes guys that got AK-47s hanging over their shoulder. But that was a little unnerving because, you know, I'd never been in this country, didn't know what to expect, and these guys just wanted to go through our stuff to see what we had. So it was the Wild West in the middle of what's now, you know, a real major city. Every turn we made over there, there was somebody that either had a gun under the seat or in their hand or their hand out actually looking for cash for you to be able to make that next step. So speaking of, you know, the naive Westerner here, you know, those guys at that point in time thought the fact that we were even over there, we had to be millionaires carrying $1 million on us, because everybody thought we had amazing amounts of cash to be able to pay off unknown people that were there around every corner.
Has there ever been a major cache of fighter aircraft or aircraft found, you know, where there's multiples and in good shape?
You know, at the end of World War II and some of our surplus yards here in the States, there were some of those aircraft available, in specifically American fighters and bombers. And there were certain guys back that were at the right place at the right time and had the money that actually were making more money on the excess fuel that was in the aircraft and the airplane itself. But they were smart. But worldwide, not really. You know, they were, remember, these airplanes were built to win a war, not last 60 years. So they didn't last very long.
In some cases, they were only meant to last a few minutes, you know.
That's true. I mean, for example, a Messerschmitt 109 was designed for 2 weeks or two missions. That's why they build over 35,000 of them to defend the German countryside there.
There's speculation, of course, that as Greenland melts, and that's not even a funny statement, that there will be some aircraft available there.
Well, they've already done some expeditions. You know, there are airplanes that have been recovered 300 feet below ice. But the weight of that ice is basically smashing them flat as a pancake. And, you know, it's great that you have an identity to build around, but that's 100% rebuild of an airplane.
Why do you think it's important, Gordon, to know about warbirds and the recovery of them? And what's behind that?
You know, during the war, all these countries were defending any way they could their freedom. And so it was an incredible escalation of technology at that point. So think about it, from the Wright brothers' first flight of 112 feet and just a few miles per hour, in less than 40 years, because of a war effort, we are going 35,000 feet, 400 miles per hour, and doing whatever we could do technology-wise to stay ahead of the enemy. A lot of that, again, these things were built to win the war. At the end of the war, a lot of them were scrapped, made into lawnmowers and dishes and all that. And I feel right now that it's really important to future generations to understand what we went through in that short period of time.
Now, this book was picked by iUniverse for the STAR program. How have you benefited from that?
Actually, the STAR program has opened a lot of doors for me. I will say that I work really hard to promote the book, and I would encourage other authors that, you know, it's great to get to different levels, and you work hard to get to those levels, but don't stop at that point with the STAR program or anything else. You know, you got to keep pushing hard to promote your story and get it out there, especially as a new subject matter.
What advice would you have for aspiring authors?
Well, if we're talking about writing memoirs or biographies, kind of, this is, a true story and nonfiction that I put together. And I just, again, would encourage people to keep a great, very detailed journal. And when you write your book, you know, write it from the heart. And more importantly, let people give you some criticism that are reading that. Criticism's okay, so be open to that.
What are some of the things that you learned about publishing? You know, working with iUniverse, of course, the leader in supported self-publishing, and what are some of the things that you learned in this process?
Well, I'm a business person for my day job. You know, I'm out there doing a lot of aircraft sales and acquisitions, and I learned real fast that publishing is a business, and they're there to make money just like any business, and that's okay. They really want to know what works, you know, for them, and it's a real challenge in any, I think, with publishing to try to sell something new, you know, kind of like what my subject is. You know, this was the first book that I had published, and I think you go in there thinking it's going to be an easy task, but, you know, I applaud iUniverse for helping me, and I actually tried traditional routes first. iUniverse stepped up and really helped me get through the process, and it gave me a real expectation of how the whole flow of writing and marketing the book was going to have to go. They're a great encouragement.
Do you plan on publishing any more books in the future?
Well, as a matter of fact, book number two is underway. And what's different from the first one is instead of dealing with the mafia and the KGB, I got to deal with headhunters and stone money in the South Pacific.
Two different groups, but, you know, the outcome could be the same, right?
I'm hopeful we get a plane back.
Gordon, what aircraft are you currently working on?
Well, we've actually got a couple of Messerschmitt 109 fighters, and these are particularly F models, which is the first variant after the Battle of Britain. And we're working with a really amazing group, kind of by you in Everett, Washington, that is restoring the aircraft to a flyable condition. It's the basis of the book. Then recently here, too, we picked up a pretty rare trainer aircraft called the PT-19. This airplane was actually owned and operated by the Tuskegee Airmen in Alabama.
The 109, of course, incredible aircraft. And there were a number of versions of that. You know, not all 109s are the same, are they?
That's correct. You know, I started with the experimental ones, and the E model was the one that was famous in the Battle of Britain. F model like we had, they only built 2,200 of the variant, and that's what makes this one so special, especially with the battle history and the group commander that flew this particular aircraft that we have.
Now, the museum, the work that you're doing with the Spirit of Flight, you're raising money for the new museum. Tell us about the Spirit of Flight.
We put together a nonprofit museum out here near Boulder, Colorado. And again, we call it Spirit of Flight. And Alan, you have this. If you got the aviation bug inside you, you can't help but look up and see what's flying overhead, no matter what it is. Is that fair?
It's a fair statement. I live beside the airport in Vancouver, and one of the reasons I do is so that I get to go out. There's a beautiful long river, a walk along the river where I watch the airplanes take off and land, and I kind of just soak up all that and nature at the same time.
Yep, you can't help it. But we put this museum together really as a gathering point to inspire the general public and to educate them on aviation and aviation history. You know, one of the things that's exciting about the facility is that the core of the collection are items that Warbird Recovery has actually recovered and brought from around the world.
Well, I had the opportunity the other day to interview Richard Clark, of course, who was the terrorist expert in both the Clinton and Bush administration, and he was the one that stood up in the front of Congress, a congressional hearing, and said, you know, I failed you and your government failed you. And I said, those that don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. And in some way, the Warbird movement of restoring and keeping these airplanes alive and the stories that go around them, they do make a difference in helping us to remember the past, appreciate the past, and the people who lived and died in that story. And so it is a vital, important part of our history as well, isn't it?
I agree with that, absolutely.
What is your wish for readers of Warbird Recovery, The Hunt for a Rare World War II Aircraft?
I'm hopeful that readers can go to an air show or to an air museum and look at a rare or a vintage aircraft and have a different appreciation for what might have happened for that airplane to get to that point, from a wreck, the history of how it got wrecked, and then the recovery of that aircraft, the whole restoration process, which could have taken years and years and years to have happened. And then maybe walk away from that aircraft or an air show, and especially the kids, to dig in a little more into the history of that particular airplane or that area of time that it may have come from.
The book is called Warbird Recovery, The Hunt for a Rare World War II Plane in Siberia, Russia. Gordon R. Page, the author, iUniverse, the publisher. Gordon, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me on, Alan. I appreciate the opportunity.
This is Alan Hunkin for Author Talk. Thanks very much for joining us. Bye for now.